We have safety too. We have the.
I like their little white scale.
I think we had 70 some pigs at one time.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were a real novelty because we had this big metal feed trough. And these pigs were really strange because all day long, this is no exaggeration, the trough was totally made out of metal. And they would stand there. Did yours chew on rocks? Well, these were really smart pigs. They would stand all day and they would chew on rocks and drop them into this metal trough. And all day long, all you heard was this bang, 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 bang. And you come down there, and these big boars and sows be standing there, and they'd be slobbering all over their mouth, and they'd be chewing, and you could just hear it. Their teeth were grinding on these rocks. It was a real novelty because people would stop by and, hey, we heard about your pigs, and we'd take them down and show them the pigs. It's like we almost started charging admission to see the pigs. People didn't believe it, but day after day after day after day, and the only reason we could find out, we tried to find out why they did that, is kind of like, you know, worries you at first. I wonder if something's wrong with them. And then we found out they were probably just bored. And that was their activity, chew on rocks. People always told us that pigs are an extremely smart animal, and I never could see how. Really, I could never see how. I guess I just differ with them on that point. Except little ones. If you try to catch a little one, you're in for a good chase. For a real good chase. Well, today, what we're going to do, we're almost done with Bible customs, and we're going to be on something else. Now, since we had a topic yesterday that pleased the young men so much, sheep, today we thought we'd render an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and we'd like to share something for our sisters. So we're going to talk briefly about marriage customs, just real briefly, and talk about a few things here and kind of give you the idea of how it went back there in the days of Palestine and during the time of Jesus. Now, the Bible talks about marriage, of course, extensively. It's ordained of God. It was divinely established by Him from the very beginning. Of course, God created the first man and the woman, and He put them together in that beautiful paradise. And when God did that, God instituted the act or the ritual of marriage, and He was the first minister. He officiated at that ceremony. And God put them together, and they were one flesh, and God gave them a commandment. And later on, the Jewish women considered this to be a very solemn and weighty commandment. And that was this. It's found in Genesis chapter 1 and verse 28. Genesis 1:28. God said, "Be fruitful, multiply, and replenish the earth." And that was the real desire of a Jewish woman, was to have children. And like we mentioned earlier, it was kind of a stigma not to even have children. Now, furthermore, they didn't only view their calling as just to be a bearer of children, but they also perceived their calling to be that of a helpmate for their husband. And they always looked at themselves as being subservient and being under their husband and to be his helpmate. And we see that in Genesis chapter 2, Genesis 2 and verse 18. And then we find in the Bible that marriage was, at least from God's viewpoint, was to be something that was to be based on an intimate commitment. And so it's not like it was just a formality. It was a real intimate covenantal commitment. And you can read of that in Matthew chapter 19 and verse 6. Now, also the Bible talks about the marriage relationship, that it was to be marked by love. Love was a real keynote above everything else that you would use to describe this marriage relationship. You'd have to use love if it's really one that's centered in God. And Paul, of course, beautifully compared the love of a man for his wife to the love that Jesus has for His church in Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 25. Ephesians 5:25. Notice the simplicity that the Bible uses to describe the marriage of Isaac and Rebekah back in the Old Covenant. It talks about in Genesis chapter 24 and verse 67. It says that Isaac took Rebekah and she became his wife, and he loved her, in Genesis 24:67. So you see, their marriage, it was not just a legal formality. The love of God was to be right there in their marriage. Now, furthermore, marriage also symbolized the union between God and His people. And it's kind of like it was a picture, it was a type of the relationship that God wanted to have with the nation of Israel. And in fact, what God told Israel is that when they forsook him, they were actually forsaking their husband, and the nation was committing fornication and adultery when it turned from God to idols. Now, there's an interesting custom that occurred back in Oriental days. I don't know the extent of it today, but that's this, that the choice of a wife was pretty much the parents' prerogative. In other words, in the East, the parents of a young man would select the bride for him. They would select the bride for him, and also with the bride, too. With the bride, often her parents would select a bridegroom for her. And they did not have the normal dating and the normal courtship periods like what we have. It was a lot different. The parents did the selecting. And for some people, that's a real blessing, and for a lot of others, that's not so much of a blessing. And, for example, in Genesis 26 and verse 34, when Esau married, he did so against the wishes of his parents. He went out and I think he married some Hittites or something like this. And that's not who they had in mind for him. And they were very, very displeased with that. It caused a lot of ill favor in his family. That's Genesis 26, verse 34. Now, generally, most married couples, therefore, fell in love after marriage and not before. It was kind of different than the way it is today in our culture. They would be hitched together, they would get married, and then they would fall in love after they were married. Now, there are some notable exceptions to this. In the Bible, we read about Jacob and Rachel. It was love at first sight for them. Jacob saw Rachel, and that's it. His heart was set on her. And same with Rachel. So there are exceptions to it. Now, generally, the bride and the groom were very young when they got married. In fact, eventually, the rabbis had to fix a minimum age at 12 for girls and 13 years old for boys. But it was very, very common to marry in their middle teens. It'd be very, very common for the male to be, let's say, 15 years old and maybe the bride to be 14 years old. And very often the bridegroom was a year or so older than the female. But very often they would be in their middle teens. And it would not have shocked anyone to see a 13-year-old boy and a 12-year-old girl get married. And they would start their marriage. And so they didn't struggle with a lot of sexual problems that young people today struggle with, because often as soon as they reached puberty and reached maturity as far as their body, they got married within a year or two, see, and launched right into marriage. And in fact, there's actually records of younger couples getting married than 12 and 13 years old. In fact, sometimes daughters were promised as young as 6 years old. Now, not that they got married then, but they were promised in marriage at 6 years of age. And at 6 years old, they knew exactly who their future husband was to be. And they were promised to them, see, maybe a nearby village or something. Now, young people did have several different socially accepted ways to meet each other in their society. You cannot keep the male and the females apart. That's impossible. God has put a certain attraction in them. And their eyes are going to wander, and they're going to be focusing on someone of the opposite sex, and they're going to have feelings of attraction towards them. I mean, that's just natural. It's normal. And so there were things like parades and festivals and harvest feasts and community dances. Now, their community dances were different than what we have in our society. They did dance in Palestine, and they did get together, and they celebrated together, and it was a time of joyous rejoicing before God and rejoicing with each other. However, in the actual matter of selecting the spouse for the child, very often it was the father that did it, and very often he could be very, very rigid, very adamant. And it just kind of depended on your father. Now, if you wanted to, you could venture an opinion to your father. You could say, well, I would like to marry so-and-so, or I have feelings of attraction towards so-and-so. And it's not like they always demanded that you marry this person that they selected for you. So you could venture an opinion, and it might be honored or it might not be honored. It just depended on how rigid your father was. And sometimes they did ask the son or the daughter if they had a preference or if they consented to the choice. Now, obviously, they did not want you to marry against your will. But there was a real strong social pressure there that they grew up with this mentality that mom and dad, they've selected this bride for me or this bridegroom, and that's going to be my wife. That's going to be my husband. And I'll worry about falling in love after the knot is tied. Now, also, they had real elaborate negotiations for actually securing the wife. Here's how it went about. First of all, you've got the young man, the young man and his father. And what the young man had to do, he had to acquire sufficient means for what is called a dowry. D-O-W-R-Y. Dowry was very, very important. A dowry was compensation given to the father of the bride for the loss of his daughter. And so this young man had to save up money. Now, they always are normally married within their own social level of society. If you were poor, normally you married someone else that was poor. If you were rich, you stayed in that social level of society. And part of that, I think, is because of the dowry thing. If you were poor, you cannot maybe afford a lot for your wife. Maybe a couple goats. And that, so it took you a long time to save up the money for goats. But it just depended. And so what they'd do, the young man would save up money for a dowry for several years, be saving his money. And then the parents would select the girl for him, and the negotiations would begin in earnest, kind of like buying a used car here now. Now, the father did not contact the father of the bride. But what they'd do is that the father would call in a man who would act as a deputy for him and his son, kind of like a lawyer or a representative. He was called a deputy. Actually, his official title was the friend of the bridegroom, paranymph in the Greek, the friend of the bridegroom, in John chapter 3, verse 29, John 3:29. So you've got this deputy now. Now, hopefully you've got a sharp one, quick talker, and hopefully he can get this gal for you with a minimum dowry, you know, without too much money involved in all this. This is really a kind of a precarious situation here. And so this deputy goes over, and meanwhile the deputy is fully informed as far as how much the dowry is and how much this young man is willing to pay for the bride. So he knows the top line and the bottom line. In other words, he knows, I can't go beyond two goats, three chickens, one cow. That's all I've got. I can't go beyond that, see? So I've got that to deal with. And so together with the father and the deputy marches over to this other person's house. And meanwhile, the bride's father, he also gets a deputy. He finds out that they're coming over, so he gets a deputy, or a friend of the bride now. And it's the two deputies that start talking to each other. It's not the parents of the bridegroom and the bride, but it's these deputies, and they talk together. And it's a real warm time of conversation, and they'll talk about it over coffee and so forth. And very often they know that the two are going to get married. It's only a matter of the dowry that's really being discussed right now. How much money is going to be given as a dowry? But very often there are two matters that have got to be settled. Matter number one is whether the father of the woman will agree to allow his daughter to marry. Now, often that's already been settled, but that's one primary thing. Will the father of the daughter allow his daughter to be married? And secondly, the amount of the dowry to be paid for her. That's the second point. And they've got to discuss those two things. Meanwhile, the young man is sitting back home, sweating it out, wondering what is happening, waiting for the latest news to come back, see? Well, when they finally agree upon a set price for the dowry, they exchange congratulations and so forth, and they split up. And that's it. And at this point in time, then, the couple is pronounced engaged, as it were, engaged or betrothed. And I'll say more about that in a few minutes. Now, let me say something about the marriage dowry itself, because we don't have that today in our society. You see, when a daughter is given in marriage, the efficiency of her father's family is diminished. She's a very valuable asset. I mean, it's not anyone that can, you know, grind grain and work around the house and tend the flocks and work in the field. She's valuable. And all of a sudden, she's gone. She's not there any longer. And so a dowry is given to this father of the bride as adequate compensation, and it's called a marriage dowry. And there's actually two different ways you could pay it. You could pay it like in cash or material goods. You could give them a sum of money, or you could give them some animals or livestock or something like that. Or if you were really poor, you could buy on time. That is, you could serve for a set period of time the father of the bride. This is if you were really, you know, hard-pressed and you had no money. Remember what Jacob did? Jacob served 7 years for Rachel and 7 years for Leah because he did not have the money for a dowry. And so he served for 7 years to pay off his dowry, as it were. He bought his brides on time, credit payment or whatever, credit installment plan. Even back during that time, they bought on credit. And you can see Genesis chapter 29, verse 18 for that. Genesis 29, verse 18. Jacob ran up quite a bill. He should have just stuck with one woman, but he got tricked and ended up with Leah, and Rachel was really the one he loved. And so, another 7 years. Usually a portion of this dowry that was given to the father of the bride was also given to the bride. And the father of the bride, he received initially the dowry, and he in turn would take some of the money and give it to his own daughter, so that when she got married, she left home with a sum of money. And that was a custom during the time of Jesus, and the reason why is because divorce was so common. And in fact, many of the Jews believed and taught, some of the Pharisees did this, that you could divorce your woman for your wife for any reason. If she burned the soup, when the soup was cooking, you could divorce her for that. For that reason alone. Or if you found anything in her that displeased you, you could divorce her. Now, the thing about it that was ironic, women could not divorce you. So the women were stuck. And they were stuck with whoever they got married to. But with the men, they could divorce their women if they got tired of you, and they could marry someone else. And therefore, when the wife was divorced, very often she would go out and she might have, you know, she might be older in age. And now all of a sudden she's got to take care of herself, and it might be very hard for her to get remarried again, see? And she might have to live on her own, and this money was given to her in that event, in the event that she was divorced. And it consisted of maybe coins on her headgear or maybe jewelry, and if her marriage ended in failure, well, then that's what she had to live on. Now, let me tell you about the betrothal period. The betrothal period was the period in which you entered into formal engagement. This is after all the financial negotiations were all settled now. And there were really three different steps to their marriage. First of all, it began with a promise of marriage. And you could actually be promised to someone else in marriage years before the actual dowry was negotiated and all that. And a promise could be broken at any time. If you were promised to a young man or a young man promised to you, let's say you were 6 years old, you could break that promise, and that would be socially acceptable. However, once the betrothal was entered into, once the dowry was negotiated, and once you had agreed to marry the other person, you entered into this betrothal period, and that was binding. You could not get out of it now. And save face. Betrothal. So this is similar to our engagement, but much more strict. Much more strict than our engagement. For example, today you might be engaged to someone and you could break the engagement and, you know, people feel sorry for you, but they don't look down upon you in any way. It's socially acceptable to do that. But during this time, the betrothal, B-E-T-R-O-T-H-A-L, was binding, and once you entered into it, it was considered final. In fact, amongst the Hebrews, you had to get a divorce even during the betrothal period. You had to write out a writing or a bill of divorcement. And so there's a real difference between betrothal and marriage. Now, between the betrothal period and the actual marriage, the Jews required that 1 year elapse. So you were engaged to your spouse very often when you were 12 or 13 years old, but you didn't get married for a whole year. For a whole year then. And normally a whole year would elapse. And so the betrothal is different than the marriage. Now, after the betrothal, though, before they were married, but after the betrothal, the couples were referred to as wife and husband. And that's what they called them, even though they were not yet married. They still called them a wife and a husband. So even during the engagement period. However, they did not consummate their union, and they did not live with each other for that entire year. And often they even lived separately in different towns or villages and were not even brought together until the actual marriage. But they knew for a year that they were going to marry this person. Their society, their customs were different. They didn't have all this dating and so forth that we've got today. Now look at the distinction seen over in Deuteronomy chapter 20, verse 7. Deuteronomy chapter 20, verse 7. So, in fact, God gave a law here. In Deuteronomy chapter 20 and verse 7, and it says this, "And what man is there that hath betrothed a wife and hath not taken her. Now the betrothal is the engagement, and the taking her is the marriage. It says, let him go and return unto his house, lest he die in the battle and another man take her. Now this was a provision that God had put in the Word of God, and it went like this. If you were betrothed to your spouse, you would not be required to fight in the wars, lest you be killed in the war during the engagement period and someone else marry your wife. So you were not required, if you were engaged then, to be enlisted in the army, the armies that they had. Let's turn over to Matthew chapter 1, verse 18. Let me read this to you. Matthew chapter 1, verse 18. Matthew 1:18. Maybe this custom will help illustrate this passage. Now the birth of Jesus Christ was on this wise. When as his mother, Mary, was espoused to Joseph, before they came together, she was found with child of the Holy Ghost. Now notice carefully, they were espoused, that is, they were betrothed, but they had not yet consummated their marriage. They were not married yet. It says in verse 19, then Joseph, her husband, and the Bible calls him a husband, even though they have not yet formally been united in marriage, being a just man and not willing to make her a public example, was minded to put her away privily. Well, maybe you've wondered about this. What is going on in this passage? Why Joseph felt like, well, I've got to divorce Mary. Well, you see, Mary and Joseph, they were legally betrothed, and they had not yet entered into their marriage, and all of a sudden, Mary was pregnant. You know, Mary was pregnant, and they had already completed all the necessary financial obligations, the dowries had been settled and everything, and in keeping with the custom, they had had no sexual relationship. None. But Mary was still pregnant. And so Joseph was still considered her husband, and Joseph could not just do away with her, could not just, you know, break the engagement or whatever. He actually had to divorce her. But Joseph loved her. Joseph was a gentle man. He was a tender man. He had a great love for her, and so he tried to dissolve this engagement period without revealing that Mary was pregnant, because there would have been a real stigma on this. People would have thought that Mary had an illicit relationship with someone. So he was a tender, loving man, and he wanted to put her away privately, divorce her privately. Now, the reason that he wanted to divorce her is because he was a holy man. He was a holy man, and it was the custom in Israel that pretty much they desired a virgin when they got married. And they looked down upon women that were not virgins before they got married. And so this was a real solemn thing for Joseph. But God intervened, and God revealed to him that this is of the Holy Ghost. Now, how often does that happen? You know, if a woman is pregnant, well, then she's pregnant. It's like my wife that had this rabbit in this rabbit cage, and the rabbit got pregnant in the rabbit cage without another rabbit. She was adamant that it got pregnant without another rabbit. And I was adamant that, no, that cannot happen. She was adamant, and I was adamant. We were both adamant. But according to the laws of nature, that rabbit cannot get pregnant without another rabbit. It's got to have another rabbit. Now, how it happened, I don't know. But all I know is I did study a little bit of biology in college and so forth, and I know enough about the birds and the bees that's what it takes. And Joseph knew that too. Yes.
Yeah, you mentioned about the holy love of Joseph.
Yes.
He also didn't stone her.
Yes.
That's
right.
He was minded to stone her, but he was minded to put her away.
Mm-hmm. That's right. According to the law, they were commanded to stone. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's talk about the apparel of the groom and the bride. Let's move on to another topic now. The apparel of the groom and the bride. And this is a rather interesting thought because, first of all, the groom, when the wedding day finally rolled around, 365 days of long waiting had now passed. Well, the groom on his wedding day, he dressed as much like a king as possible. This was his special day. They had a crown for him, often a rich gold crown. In fact, often they would keep this crown, and it was used by several of the different villagers. They would share it. But if they were very poor, well, then a garland of fresh flowers would do. And he had beautiful garments that were scented with frankincense and myrrh. And these were often very special garments that he wore, special tunic. And it was scented with beautiful fragrance. And then also he wore a brilliantly colored silk girdle that was real startling in contrast. And he wore a handsome, loose, flowing robe like a king would wear. So he looked like a king, just like a king. And let me read to you Isaiah chapter 61, verse 10 here. This was a real major event for the Jews, a marriage. It was the highlight of their entire life when they got married. Isaiah 61, verse 10, it says, "And I will greatly rejoice in the Lord. My soul shall be joyful in my God, for he hath clothed me with the garments of salvation. He has covered me with the robe of righteousness, as a bridegroom decketh himself with ornaments, and as a bride adorneth herself with her jewels." Talks about the bridegroom decking himself with ornaments right there. And then with the bride, they really went all out with her. They had a very, very costly and elaborate ornaments that were given onto her. They spent a lot of time in preparing her. There were several women involved in preparing her. First of all, her complexion was made glossy, very shiny. It was said to shine like marble, polished marble, and I don't know how they did that. But then they would take the dark locks of her hair, and they would braid them with gold and pearls. I've got some slides and pictures of this, and it is just stunning. It is beautiful. It's like in every braid, all these little minute braids, there are jewels woven into her hair, and braids woven into her hair. And they had long hair that often went halfway down their back or farther, see. And all their hair was woven with these beautiful jewels and with gold and pearls. And then they were decked with all the precious stones and all the jewels that all of her relatives had. What they did, they borrowed all the jewels from the relatives. And if they didn't have many relatives or if their relatives were poor, then people in the village chipped in. And they were covered with jewels, covered with pearls, covered with ornaments. Literally. I mean, if you see it, you look at them, and it's like there's 100 pounds of jewels on them. And it says over in Jeremiah chapter 23 and verse 2. Jeremiah 23, verse 2. Jeremiah asks, concerning the nation of Israel, he says, "Can a maid forget her ornaments or a bride her attire?" And he's implying to them, "But you have forgotten God." And the implication is that a bride could never forget her attire on that day in which she is married. And then there is a going out of the groom to get the bride. The bridegroom himself went in person to the bride's house, and the bride was waiting at home for him. And he would march down the streets, and there was a great procession that would follow him. And he would march all the way to her home, and he would actually take her. He'd knock on the door or whatever, and he would get his bride, and now he was going to take her back to his father's house, because she was now leaving her father's house. So he would go, and she would leave her father's house, and she would be adorned, and she would be perfumed, and there would be a crown on her head. And meanwhile, as they went back to the father's house, they'd be walking down the streets, the entire village would turn out. Often these were small villages, and it was a big, big affair. And there was a grand procession that followed the bride and the groom all the way to their house. Everyone carried a blazing torch. This was often done in the evening. They had a blazing torch, and there were lamps, and there were bands that played their drums and musical instruments along the way. So there's drums being played, torches being blazed away there, and food is thrown to the children along the way. It's a time of great rejoicing. A big shindig. And so finally, they arrive at the father's house. And of course, this is the most important part of the entire marriage festivity. And as soon as the bridegroom arrives there at the father's house, the older women take her and they arrange a veil over her. Now she has a veil over her. And what that symbolized is that she now had to be veiled in the public because she belonged to one man. And she was holy. She was separated onto one man now. So there was a veil put over her. And then she was taken to her husband again, husband-to-be, and they were led to a place under a canopy. And, of course, the Jewish people, they use this canopy type affair even today. And they're led underneath this canopy, and there's a short benediction pronounced over them, and very often they would not even have a rabbi or anyone officiate, but just a benediction or a prayer was pronounced over them, and that's it. They were declared husband and wife, and they were married. And then at that point in time, there's a cup of wine, and they'll take the cup of wine, and both of them drink the cup of wine, and then this is called the wine of marriage consecration. And it's partaken of with great rejoicing, and everyone is rejoicing, everyone is singing, everyone is laughing. And then, in the midst of all of this, there is one sad item of significance that is done. After they drink the wine, the groom takes the glass, and he smashes it on the floor. Takes the thing and smashes it right on the floor. And what that symbolized, it was a memorial. And it symbolized the destruction of the temple. Solomon's temple. The Babylonians came down and destroyed it. And right in the midst of all this joyous festivity, they would take the glass and smash it on the ground as a memorial to the temple. And what that taught the Jews is that even in their supreme moment of happiness, they were to never forget the deep sorrows of their nation. They were never to forget Jerusalem. They were never to forget the destruction of the temple. And that was a reminder right there in the midst of all of this. And it said, this is all based on Psalm chapter 137. Psalm 137 and verse 5. It says, if I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget her cunning. And if I do not remember thee, let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth, if I prefer not Jerusalem above my chief joy. So it's like they needed some object lesson there, lest they forget Jerusalem. Boy, they were into legalism, weren't they? It's kind of like God is saying, well, I'll make exceptions here on their marriage day. If they forget everything else, that's fine. That's understandable. But they had this broken glass right there. Now, at that point in time, they entered into a seven-day wedding feast. For 7 days, there was a wedding feast. And everyone who attended the wedding feast, which was everyone pretty much, everyone that was in any way connected with the family attended. They were required to wear a wedding garment, which was often a white garment. And during this time, the bride and the groom received benedictions from all the relatives and all the friends and all the family. And for 7 days, they danced, they rejoiced, they praised God, they exchanged gifts, they played games. And for 7 days like that, and it lasted an entire week, the wedding festivities. And after that, that's it. You were now husband and wife. So it was quite a major event, quite a major celebration. Yes?
7 days.
Yeah, everyone just stayed at that house. And it was the house of the bridegroom, his father's house. And he paid for everything. That was part of the bill, too. So it was costly to have a son get married. Very costly. To feed all those people for 7 days and to take care of them. You know, and I mean, it was a lavish affair. Lots of food. And yes. Right, exactly. Yeah, he was. Right. Yeah, and they would often move right in there with their mom and dad. And if they lived in a tent, they just added another room to the tent. Or if they lived in a house, they just... Well, I suppose that, depending on the situation, they might live nearby, but basically they were still connected with the father. Anything else? Well, what do you think? Think that sounds like a better way to go with your parents? Some of you young men that are nervous about asking a woman out, maybe you might think that it might be better. Huh? You need a Well, there's some brothers that are lawyers in the church. You might ask them. They might represent you. Do you have any livestock or anything, Lewis? I don't know, these women might consider it an insult if you felt like they're worth, you know, three goats or something. Yes.
That breaking of the glass, is that
That's a good idea. I don't know if that carried over into our culture from that or not. I don't know what the symbolism of that is. But I know with the Jews it was a memorial, the destruction of the temple. And I don't know if they borrowed that from another culture or other cultures borrowed it from them. Yes.
Yeah.
Right. Just got married during that time. That would have been very, very much against the the society, very much against. And I don't think, you mean just two people just go off by themselves and get married and just come back married. That would not have happened very, very often. That would be a real, real exception to the rule. Real exception. This was a major thing. And the parents had much more control over the lives of the children than what our parents do now. In fact, even now, I know a brother, I won't mention his name, but he's been a good friend of mine for years. His parents immigrated to America from China. And so his parents came over during the communist takeover. And, of course, he himself was born, I think he was born here in America. But their family structure is still so tight that he had several brothers and sisters, and his other younger brothers and sisters could not get married until he got married. And it's like he was here in the church, and for several years, you know, he's trying to find someone to marry and could not find someone, and his parents pressured and pressured and pressured him because they would not marry out of order. And you see that just little social custom right there, and he followed it. I mean, he obeyed it. And it's like all his other brothers and sisters were getting antsy because they were getting a little bit up in age, and there were people that they wanted to marry, but they couldn't get married until he got married. And I said that just to say that the Oriental ways are much more strongly entrenched than our ways. Yes. The church, and for several years, you know, he's trying to find someone to marry and could not find someone, and his parents pressured and pressured and pressured him because they would not marry out of order. And see that just little social custom right there, and he followed it. I mean, he obeyed it. And it's like all his other brothers and sisters were getting antsy because they were getting a little bit up in age, and there were people that they wanted to marry, but they couldn't get married until he got married. And I said that just to say that the Oriental ways are much more strongly entrenched than our ways. Yes. 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 Yeah, that's true. Yep, that's really true. Okay, well, let's move on. I've got one brief custom to share with you. It's found in Psalm chapter 56 and verse 8. And then I've got one other, and then we're done with Bible customs, and we're going to talk about an entirely different topic. Oh, we need to have a little quiz on Greece and Rome next week. Just a little one. Just a little one. Cub Scout honor. But, so read over what we mentioned on Greece and Rome. And note the major people that were tied in with Bible history. For example, you know, what are the Roman emperors who are reigning, you know, during the time of Jesus or whatever. You need to note things like that. Or what are the Grecian emperors that really were a significant portion of Bible history? Who ruled down in Egypt? Things like this. So that's only those two countries there. Only on Greece and Egypt. Probably a week from today we'll have that. Just a short quiz on that. Let me read to you Psalm chapter 56, verse 8. Talk about one brief little custom here that's kind of interesting. I was going to say a lot more about this, but for lack of time, I don't. I wanted to talk briefly about the Egyptian, or I should say the Oriental way of looking at sorrow when someone would die. And they had a different way of doing it. Normally, what would happen when someone died, there was immediately a loud shriek that was heard throughout the entire village. I mean, a loud shriek that made your blood curdle and your hair stand on edge, as it were. And someone would often they'd hire the person to do it, and they'd just scream at the top of their voice. And then what they'd do, it was very customary. They had a period of mourning for a couple of days often, and they hired mourners to come in and mourn for the dead. And these people would come, and they were hired. That was their profession. That was their livelihood. They were kind of like the morticians of the day, I suppose, or the funeral directors of the day, and their entire calling was just to mourn for the dead. And they would show up at your house, and you paid so much money to hire them, and all your relatives came to your house to mourn for the dead, and it was the entire job of these mourners to get everyone to cry and to get them to mourn. And what they'd do, they'd tell stories about the bereaved, and they'd really put their whole heart into it, and they'd say what a good guy he was and everything, and say, isn't it a shame he's gone, and so forth, and they'd get everyone to cry and everyone to... It sounds so different than it sounds so fabricated. It sounds, and it was to a certain extent. They would weep and mourn, and they could just shriek to high heaven and cry. And they would dance, and they'd fall on the floor and shriek and so forth. They also had something that was called a tear bottle. Tears and tear bottles, which we don't have today. But they had during that time. It says it in Psalm chapter 56, verse 8. David, talking to God, said, "Thou tellest my wanderings, put thou my tears into thy bottle, are they not in thy book?" He talks about God putting David's tears into my bottle. And he's talking about God. Now, Lord, you remember all my tears. And, Lord, you see every single sorrow that I'm going through. And if you look at the heading of the psalm, it will tell you the context here. Look at the heading of it. It says in Psalm 56, "To the chief musician upon," whatever that word is, "when the Philistines took him in Gath." This was a time of persecution for David, time of great sorrow, and he's captured by the Philistines, the nation's worst enemy, and it was a difficult situation, and he's praying before God, and there are very many, numerous tears that he's offering unto God, and he's saying, "Now, Lord, you remember all my tears." Now, what they had during this time, they had what were called tear bottles. These were real bottles that they had. They were rather small in size. They were made out of alabaster, and they had a long, slender body. They were broad at the base, and they had a funnel-shaped top to them. So they looked like a long, narrow, thin vase, kind of like this, like that, made out of alabaster. They have found many, many tear bottles in graves, archaeologists have. And every single member of the family had their own tear bottle, and they'd often carry it with them, and they kept a cork in it. They'd have a cork in it. And it was very customary when people were mourning, like at a funeral, to take their tear bottle out and to collect their tears. And they would put them below their eyes, and they would collect their tears. I know it really sounds strange, but they would store up their tears in their tear bottles, and they would carefully preserve them. They'd keep the thing corked like that. And often, if you were really in grief, and you were just weeping and crying and weeping and crying, and you were uncontrollable, then someone else would hold the tear bottle for you and collect your tears for you. And they did this their whole life. They collect these tears their whole life, year after year after year after year. And as they wept and wailed and tears rolled down, every single person would take their tear bottle out, like at a funeral, and they'd be standing around gathering their tears. And this bottle, of course, was extremely sacred to them. You didn't want to drop it on a rock and break it or something after years and years of collecting your tears. And it represented all the heartaches and all the sorrows of life. That's what it represented. All your heartaches, all your sorrows. And when a person died, his tear bottle was buried with him. They'd bury the tear bottle with him. Now you say, well, why did they have such a bottle? Well, it probably was based on a lot of superstition that they would have to prove to God that they were righteous. This is what the authorities are saying now, that one day they knew they'd stand before God, and this tear bottle would be a proof before God that they had suffered, that they were righteous, that they had wept, that they'd had many pains in order to obtain the mercy and the pity of God. Look at my tear bottle. It is full to the brim. Can't even get the cork in it. So many tears, Lord. And the Lord would have mercy on them, see? And so David was praying this very thing, and he was saying, "Now, Lord, I'm amongst the Philistines. I don't have my tear bottle, so you store up my tears." That's evidently what he was praying. Now, there are some people that conjecture over in Luke chapter 7. Let me read this to you. I don't know if this is true or not. Some authorities conjecture this. In Luke chapter 7 and verse 36, that this woman may have used her tear bottle to wash the feet of Jesus. It says in Luke 7:36, "And one of the Pharisees desired him that he would eat with him. And he went into the Pharisee's house and sat down to meat. And behold, a woman in the city which was a sinner, when she knew that Jesus sat at meat in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster box of ointment and stood at his feet behind him weeping and began to wash his feet with tears. And he'd wiped them with the hairs of her head and kissed his feet and anointed them with ointment. Now, from what I've seen of women, I think it is possible that a woman may be able to cry strong enough to wash his feet with tears. You know, a person can really cry under a certain situation. But others had conjectured that she may have actually uncorked her tear bottle and, as a sign of sacrifice, poured it out on the feet of Jesus. And pouring out all of her tears, all of her grief on him. And then also, she poured out her costly ointment as well, which represented a great, great sum of money. And it was a great sacrifice. If that's true, it was a great sacrifice done in love, which could never be replaced now, representing all of her sorrows being given to Jesus. Now, the Bible says in Revelation chapter 21, verse 4, that God shall wipe away all your tears in heaven. Revelation chapter 21, verse 4. So, when you get to heaven, my friend, there's no tear bottles. No tear bottles. Okay, I think, Kimberly, maybe you had a question, or... When the bottle got full, maybe it was big enough or something that, you know, it didn't get full, or maybe they kept several bottles. Maybe they did that. I don't know. I know that they found graves with several tear bottles in them, so maybe the person did collect several of them throughout his lifetime. And sometimes, you know, you're going to be caught without your tear bottle. I don't think they always kept it with them. Kind of hard to be out there in the field working and so forth with this thing banging around on your girdle, your tear bottle. And sometimes, you know, you don't ask for crying, it just happens in unexpected areas. So what I'm saying is they probably weren't able to collect all their tears, probably just at select times of grief. But they came to your funeral and they made sure they had their little bottle with them. Well, the last final point that we're going to talk about here is dwelling places in Palestine. What was it like? What did they live in? Well, a lot of different items. If you go way back in time now, the first original structures were tents. In the Bible, living in tents is of very ancient origin. It goes all the way back to the time of Abraham, and even before that, in fact, goes all the way back to the time of Jubal, way back in Genesis 4:20. It says in Genesis 4:20 that Jubal was the father of such as dwell in tents. Well, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob probably lived most of their lives in a tent. They probably did not live in permanent structures. And we find from the book of Genesis, very often it talks about them living in their tents. Now, when Israel came up out of Egypt, and they wandered for 40 years, obviously for 40 years, they lived in tents. And then when they came into the promised land for many years, they lived in tents. Now, there were homes that were already built, and they did move into those, but for the rest that did not have a pre-built home, they lived in their tents. And so you'll read even in the book of Kings, it will talk about Israel, and it will say, "To your tents, O Israel," because many were still living in tents. And you can read of that in 1 Kings chapter 12, verse 16. 1 Kings 12, 16. Now, as far as the tent material, it was made out of black goat's hair, which is a very coarse, heavy fabric. It would protect the family in the wintertime from cold winds. And then in the summertime, the sides would be lifted up, and it would be just kind of like a tarp suspended over them. And it would serve as a shade from the sun. And when the goat's hair is dry, it's very porous. It breathes. Air will come through it. But then it becomes waterproof when it gets wet because the material swells, and it does not leak water, so it's good in that regard. Goat's hair is also called sackcloth in the Bible. When the Bible talks about sackcloth, it's talking about this black goat's hair. And they would wear this sackcloth during a time of, well, let's say sorrow or humility or repentance. They would be clothed in sackcloth, fasting and worshiping before God. Now, as far as the actual tent itself, it pretty much consisted of just one large pole or maybe a couple of poles. Real simple. And when it was draped over these large poles, and then it was staked with stakes that would pull out the sides of the cloth. So just real simple, composed of one large awning which is held up by poles, and then the ends of the tent cloth are drawn out by cords and tied to pegs and driven into the ground. So just real simple. As far as the inside arrangement of the tent, if you were to peer inside, what would it be like? Normally they're rectangular in shape, square rooms, divided into two and maybe sometimes three apartments. The first apartment that you came into was the men's apartment. That's where the men slept. and it was also the guest chamber. If you had a guest, you would serve your guest in this opening chamber. Now, beyond this chamber was a second chamber, and that was where the women slept. The women slept in the second chamber along with the children. And then if they were wealthier, they might have actually a third apartment, and that would be for any servants or cattle. But normally they only had two. Now, the women in the inner apartment obviously were screened when they were in their compartment from the view of the guests. And often the males would go in this guest chamber, the first entrance there, and visit with each other. But you know what the women were doing? They could hear what was going on. That's a real temptation for a woman. No offense to you women, but you know that there's that curiosity there. And so often they would listen to the conversation through the tent walls. Well, that's what Sarah did. Sarah overheard, what the angels were saying to Abraham. And that's seen in Genesis chapter 18, verse 10. Genesis 18, verse 10. There are some temptations that are too heavy to be borne, and that would be one of them, to demand a woman to be in the tent there and not listen in to what's going on. Am I telling the truth? It'd be the same for men. It's not really that big of a difference between us, I don't think. And then furnishings, as far as the tent itself. Of course, the tent dwellers are on the move constantly, so furnishings are to a minimal. What they'll do is, the ground, of course, is dirt, so they cover the ground with rugs. And at nighttime, they'll take out bedding, like maybe a blanket or something, and they'll cover up with their blankets. Or maybe they'll just sleep on a mat. Maybe they won't even have blankets. Maybe all they had to cover up with was their outer garment, which was worn during the daytime. If you looked inside, you'd find sacks of grain piled around the middle pole, and the sacks of grain were for their livestock, and also it would keep the pole in place. And you'd notice that hanging from the poles, there was a skin bag often, like that of a goat or a lamb or something, and it would be filled with water or some other liquid. You'd notice that there was a real absence of cooking utensils, maybe a few pots and maybe a couple of kettles and maybe a couple of pans. You'd notice maybe one or two primitive clay lamps that were burning with olive oil in them. But other than that, that's pretty much it. As far as actual furniture, that all they had was the saddle from the camel, if they had a camel. They've got these huge saddles that they would put on the camels. And they might have that there, but other than that, pretty much bereft of any real furniture. And then as far as the tent itself, it's interesting that the tent was never new, and it was never old. They had a way of patching it. And what they did is they collected goat's hair all year long, and they wove it into cloth, and they would cut like a couple feet off the tent every year, and they would add a couple new feet to it. So the entire tent was becoming, as it were, new all the time. They would add to it every single year and cut the old part off. So a tent might be hundreds of years old, might be passed on from great-grandpa to grandpa to father to son, and they would constantly add to it like this over the years, so it had some real class, real style to it. Well, when we move on, we find that as they progressed in Palestine, tents were kind of a nuisance. If you ever go backpacking, you find about 1 to 2 weeks living in a tent is enough. Our brother here lived a summer in a tent, and, you know, trying to dress yourself in tents all the time and during the rain and so forth, especially if you're living with another guy. I went backpacking with one brother in the church for 2 weeks, and he woke up one morning, and we hadn't been shaving for 2 weeks or anything. He looked at me and said, "If I see your ugly mug one more morning..." he said, he said, "You make a fine friend, but a poor wife to look at. I mean, you're nothing like my wife when I wake up in the morning." So tent life is nothing like a more permanent structure. So they advanced in life, and they started building homes. And the early homes in Palestine were homes of one room. That's all they had. And that pretty much was the vast majority of people. The average home of a common person, it was a one-room dwelling. And normally, the house was just pretty much a place to sleep in. In fact, it's interesting that in the Hebrew language, they do not have a word for home. They did not call their house a home, they called it a house. And the reason why is the Palestinians spent so much time outdoors. The climate is much more temperate than here. And often they would sleep outside on the roof, and they spent a lot of time outdoors. And so they really don't even consider their house a home, but rather really just a shelter. Now, as far as the floors and the walls of the house, The houses had no floors. They were pretty much made out of dirt. They would take the dirt and pound it solid, but it was pretty much a packed hard earthen floor. If you were a little bit more well-to-do, you might be able to afford some lime and take and mix the lime together with mud, spread it out on your floor, and you had kind of a glorified mud floor, kind of like a real poor, weak cement. The walls, well, they were made out of mud. And, of course, you can't make it out of solid mud or it will just collapse, and so they would reinforce it with things like reeds or with weeds or thorn bushes or stakes or something like this. And because your walls were made out of dirt, too, often it was a breeding place for vermin like spiders. And the Bible warns them, don't lean your hand against the wall of your house suddenly, lest there be a serpent.